Welcome back to Health Bite, my friends. I'm so happy to have you here. I am feeling pumped. It's the first week of April. Spring equinox is behind us this past week. Happy Easter to all of you who celebrated this past weekend. There is a feeling of newness and rebirth and potential in the air, and a great time to get proactive about our health and well-being. So I am so glad you're here for this episode because we are going to talk about some of the important health, nutrition, weight loss, and well-being news in the headlines. Welcome back to Health Bite. I'm your host, Dr. Adrienne Udeem. I'm a triple board certified internist, obesity medicine and physician nutrition specialist, and I help people like you redefine nutrition to include not only the food that we eat, but all the ways that we can nourish ourselves physically, mentally, and emotionally. And this week, we are diving into some of the most important news health lines in health and nutrition, weight loss, and well-being. And you know what? We haven't done a news bite in several months. So let's catch up. Okay. So, first on the agenda is just a little note because I did an entire podcast on this topic early last month, but it's so important that I want to re-mention that the FDA approved a new indication for Wegovy or semaglutide. Yep, that's the weight loss drug. But the new indication is to reduce the risk of cardiovascular death, heart attack, and stroke in adults who have cardiovascular disease, as well as a diagnosis of either overweight or obesity. Now, this is huge because, as such, it is the first weight loss medication to also be approved to help prevent life-threatening cardiovascular events in adults with cardiovascular disease. Given that heart disease is the number one cause of death in men and women in the United States, this is a huge, huge preventive strategy. And I mentioned in that last podcast, you can go back and listen to it from the first week in March. This drug has been shown in clinical studies to reduce the risk of heart attacks by 20%. Actually, it results in 1.5 million reduction in cardiovascular events. That is so substantial, to say the least. It's an understatement to say so. It's also the kind of labeling that we need to change the minds of our third-party payers. And those of you who are on this drug know how difficult it has become to obtain this drug. In fact, we just got word a couple weeks or months ago from Anthem Blue Cross in California that not only have they changed the labeling or the approval of this drug to start at people who have a BMI of 40 or greater, that is up to 13 BMI points greater than what the medical societies and guidelines say, about 100 pounds of additional extra weight than what is indicated. So again, raising that bar so high to be able to qualify for this drug. But they also made it such that you have to have a BMI of 40 or greater in order to re-approve for the drug. That means if you got approved and used the drug and successfully lost weight and brought your BMI down to below 40, which is what we are trying to do with these drugs, then you will no longer qualify to get approved or reapproved for the drug, meaning that you lose coverage for the drug. And studies have shown, as I mentioned, one that was published in JAMA several months ago, that people who are on drugs like the GLP-1s will regain their weight most commonly or most often once they come off of it. But as long as, or as much as I love to bash our third-party payers and our insurance companies because they are the bane of my existence, the responsibility does not rest only on them. And I want to point out a study that was, or an article that was published in Fortune just last week that showed that semaglutide could profitably be produced for less than $5 a month. So while the cost, the cash pay cost is over $1,300 per month, this drug can be produced in as little as 89 cents per shot, equating to a month's supply for less than $4.75. That's less than a matcha from Alfred's Coffee. Now, I do want to keep in mind that the drug companies go through years and years of research and R&D in order to produce a drug. So we can't just equate the cost to the cost of manufacturing, but it does mean that we need to do better. We need to do better. We need to limit our greed in terms of how much we make off of the backs of people who have this disease and need this life-changing treatment. So enough of my soapbox, but I think change is coming. I think all of this is really positive and hopeful news for the health of our country. Okay, to other news. March was National Colon Cancer Awareness Month, and a good time to highlight some research that showed that colorectal cancer is now the number one cause of cancer death for men under the age of 50, and the number two cause of cancer death in women under 50. So that means if you were born between ages or between the years of 1981 and 1996, which is pretty darn young, studies show that you have two times the risk of developing colorectal cancer as compared to people who were born in 1950. Let me repeat that. So if you were born between 1981 and 1996, puts you in your 40s and 30s, late 30s, you have two times the risk of developing colon cancer as compared to people who were born in 1950. That is a pretty surprising statistic. As a result of this trend, the USPSTF, which is the United States Preventive Services Task Force, changed its recommendations in 2021 for people to begin getting colon cancer screening at age 45 instead of the previously recommended age of 50. So what that means is for all of you who are age 45 or greater, you need to be screened. And again, this is not a very new change. It came out in 2021, but it's still not well known. I know that when I talk to my patients in the office, they are not aware of this change in screening guidelines. And what's worse is that insurance companies are not necessarily on board with covering colonoscopies in these younger folks. And some physicians may dismiss alarming symptoms in younger people. Unfortunately, our ingrained biases sometimes dismiss symptoms, which can be concerning, which all means that you need to be proactive in your own care. Now, you know that this podcast is all about empowering you. I don't give you these alarming statistics to scare you, but I do want to arm you with the necessary information so that you do what is right for your body. So, if you are 45 or older, you need to be screened. And screening is a very effective way to detect and prevent colon cancer. Now, you may be wondering, why has there been such an uptick in colon and rectal cancer in younger adults? And as always, lifestyle factors like diet, obesity, lack of exercise, tobacco, alcohol use, as well as environmental toxins have been shown to be culprits, as well as family history, of course. But I want to point out that while these factors are named as potential risk factors, it can happen to healthy people too. So please don't use your healthy lifestyle as an excuse to avoid or delay screening. Also, keep in mind that certain symptoms like bleeding, severe constipation, urgency to have a bowel movement or frequent bowel movements, unexplained weight loss, abdominal pain, and obstruction, meaning the inability to pass gas or to have a bowel movement, are some, this is not a complete list, but are some of the signs that should be investigated. So bottom line, in the spirit of Colon Cancer Awareness Month that ended just yesterday at the time of this recording, get screened if you're 45 or older, and please follow up on any unusual symptoms, no matter how old you are. On to other news. For those of you who have listened to Health Bite, for those of you who have read my book, Hungry for More, you know that Alzheimer's disease is very near and dear to my heart. My own father, who is a self-proclaimed intellectual snob and a double PhD, was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease during COVID. Thank goodness he is so well compensated that we can't, or most people can't tell normally, but Alzheimer's is a significant diagnosis in the United States, and it is on the rise. An estimated 6.9 million Americans aged 65 and older are living with Alzheimer's in 2024. 73% are age 75 or older, and about 11% of people age 65 or older have Alzheimer's. And think about it, 65 is really young. According to a new report that came out just a few weeks ago from the Alzheimer's Association, the number of cases is only predicted to rise, as it is estimated that it will double to almost 13 million people affected by the year 2050. Again, we don't know exactly why cases are on the rise. It's probably multifactorial, like most things are, meaning that you can't pin it on one thing only. But again, lifestyle factors are implicated. Another study that came out last week identified three modifiable risk factors for Alzheimer's and dementia. Now, remember that dementia is a much broader category, and Alzheimer's is only one type of dementia, which specifically refers to a disease in which plaques are built up in certain parts of the brain. It is diagnosed through cognitive testing and through imaging that reveals these plaques and this buildup in the brain. But in this particular study, they researched and looked through 40,000 brain scans from a large-scale database, looking at the contributions of genetics and the environment to the development of various diseases to determine which environmental factors had the greatest impact on the brain areas that are affected by dementia and Alzheimer's in particular. The researchers looked at over 160 risk factors for dementia, and they were divided into broad categories, but they included things like blood pressure, cholesterol, diabetes, excess weight, alcohol consumption, smoking, depression, inflammation, pollution, sleep issues, socialization or lack of socialization, diet, physical activity, and education. So this was really a broad-ranging study looking at a broad range of potential risk factors. And they found three key risk factors that increase the likelihood of developing dementia. And they were diabetes, alcohol use, and traffic-related air pollution. So, okay, I live in Los Angeles, And I may just have to let that air pollution thing go. There's not much I can do about that one unless I'm willing to move. And I'm not willing to move, not quite yet. But alcohol, that one I can manage. And I know that abstinence is a tough sell, but it doesn't have to be. As always, I encourage you to meet yourself where you are at and take it from there. So maybe if you're a regular drinker, you become a once in a while drinker. If you're once in a while drinker and you binge when you drink, which means that you have three or more at one time, then maybe you decide to set some kind of limit to your drinking when you do drink. Any kind of change is impactful. So again, in the spirit of this podcast, to offer you actionable guidance, meet yourself where you're at. Take a look at what you are doing and see how you can make small but powerful, impactful changes in your health and well-being. And as you know, I have recorded several podcasts on the effect of alcohol on our minds and bodies, on our mental, emotional, and physical health. And as I have shared with you on the podcast and in my book, I have had a reckoning with my own relationship with alcohol and what I believe to be a healthful, and now know is not a helpful habit in my life. In terms of the other risk factor, diabetes, well, a lot can be done there in terms of prevention and lifestyle-related treatment. You know that a lot can be said about the correlation between weight and diabetes, and most of you know about that one, but here's something you may not know. Regular exercise, even if you don't lose an ounce of weight, will reduce your risk of developing diabetes if you're at risk and will help you manage blood sugars if you do have diabetes. So think about it. Your muscles need energy or glucose in order to work. And when you move regularly, when you use your muscles regularly, you bring down your overall blood sugar because the muscles are utilizing the blood sugar that's available to them. Now, I also want to remind you that you may be one of those people who has tried exercise in the past for the purposes of weight loss. Perhaps you signed up for a gym or got a trainer, decided to work out two or three times a week, did it for several months. Maybe you did it for months and months and months and noticed that you didn't lose weight and threw in the towel. What I'm telling you is that the benefit of exercise is far beyond what it does to the scale. And in this case, we know that regular exercise brings down the risk of diabetes and helps you control diabetes if you have it. And that in turn impacts your risk of dementia. Remember again, that dementia is a wide range of disorders. And so vascular dementia, which is another very common cause of dementia in the United States, has the same risk factors as cardiovascular disease. So think diabetes, of course, think hypertension, high cholesterol. And guess what? Exercise positively impacts all of those things as well. Not to mention that studies have shown a direct correlation between exercise and cognition. So if you're moving your body regularly, then you are more likely to have a healthy, usable brain much longer into your life. So the take-home message here is, please, let's not hijack movement by marrying it to weight loss. The benefits of exercise to your health and well-being are so much more profound. So if you are not moving yet, get moving. And once again, I want you to meet yourself where you're at. Not exercising, commit to whatever it takes to get your foot in the door. Maybe that's 10 minutes, maybe that's 15 minutes a day. Don't tell me you don't have 10 or 15 minutes a day. Make a commitment to engage in that amount of exercise starting today. And then once you've done that consistently, you can take it from there. I think that's enough, right? That's a good amount of health news and actionable guidance. I hope this episode was useful to you. If it was, please head over to the app where you listen and leave us a review. So many of you are responding to my newsletters and sending me DMs on Instagram, telling me that you love the podcast. I love you, but it would really help a lot if you would go and leave me a review so that we can take this message further. Last but not least, if you're not on my newsletter, head over to the show notes, get onto my weekly newsletter, and I will send you my guide to better health and well-being. I have tips in there. I have prompts and writing exercises in there. I have guidance on diet, exercise, sleep, mindfulness, movement, contemplative practices, all the stuff that I talk about on this podcast every week and that I absolutely love marinating in and sharing with you. So I hope you have a wonderful first week of April, and I look forward to seeing you here again next week on Health Bite. Until then, bye now.